Good morning. It's the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and Wisconsin spring elections are a week from tomorrow, and we're getting a preview of what's on the ballot with Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagnendonk. We're also getting updates on all of the news stories about voting, vote counting, and election monitoring in Wisconsin, along with the constitutional amendments that will be on your ballot a week from tomorrow. You can join our conversation at any time by joining us over the phone at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email always open to you, ideas@WPR.org. Anya Van Wagnendonk is WPR State Capitol Reporter. And Anya, welcome back to The Morning Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the first constitutional amendment proposal on April 2nd's ballot, and that would ask whether private funds should be allowed for election administration. If passed, Anya, how would this amendment affect elections?
Yeah, so this comes after the 2020 election. Nearly every state received some federal money and then also private money to deal with administering elections during COVID. That was obviously a situation where elections required much more support than is typical. And one sort of significant source of funds in many communities, including across Wisconsin, were grants allocated by a group operated by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Some people might remember that these were referred to as Zuckerbucks. And they were pointed by some people who questioned the outcome of the 2020 election as sort of an area of fraud or disenfranchisement. For complicated reasons, basically in Wisconsin, the largest grants went to the biggest cities. Cities tend to vote Democratic. And so for people who were not happy with the outcome of the election, it gave the impression of interference or at the very least sort of prioritizing voting access in Democratic areas. So if this is passed, private grants like that would not be allowed. It's worth noting that sort of even in ordinary circumstances, not during a pandemic, elections are quite underfunded. And so when you ask what the effect would be, it would sort of cut off one avenue for funding polling places and poll worker training, ballot printing, all those little sort of details that go into elections.
And you spoke with Emily Lau, who is a staff attorney with UW-Madison's State Democracy Research Initiative. And here's a bit of what Lau had to say about the amendment.
Those in favor of the amendment argue that if this amendment were to be passed and that these outside donations are prohibited, that they will increase election integrity and also increase trust in elections. But there's also concern on the other side that elections across the nation are chronically underfunded.
Is there evidence to support both sides of this? Argument, Anya? Are both supporters and opponents of the amendment saying this amendment is about trust in elections?
Yeah, I think one of the kind of major things we've seen since 2020 is that trust in elections is just very much in the eye of the beholder. So people who support this amendment say removing, you know, any private actors from our elections help remove that threat of outside interference, and so that will improve trust. But people who oppose the amendment say having an underfunded election process, which could lead to machine malfunctions or super long lines, super long processing times, all of those things undermine trust. And so they might argue that kind of bringing in more money to patch up those holes and make the experience better for voters, that that's better for public perception.
So, Anya, then, if we as voters on next Tuesday, a week from tomorrow, vote yes or vote no, what will this mean for our voting going forward? What will this mean for our elections going forward?
Yeah, so sometimes ballot initiatives, I think, can get us trapped in sort of double negative land.
Right.
So if you are someone who does not want private money in private grant money in elections, then you want to vote yes on question one. And then if you are someone who does want localities to have that option of receiving private funds for elections, you want to vote no on question one. That's against barring private money in elections.
And what do you hear about Wisconsin's funding of elections? Are they underfunded as according to those who are on the ground, our clerks and those who are working in our elections?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting about Wisconsin compared to many other states is how decentralized our election administration is. So we have something like 1,800 clerks administering each election. They do sort of extraordinary work, but many of them are definitely working on a shoestring. And so because we don't have a more kind of centralized system, that does mean that a lot of communities are really pulling it together kind of as they can. And so that does mean that funding just is spread out a little bit differently than it might be in a more centralized administrative system.
Is there any talk about increasing funding for Wisconsin's elections?
Not that I've seen sort of make it through the legislature. So public money, I have not seen moving towards an increase. And so that is why some of these communities do rely on, you know, applying for private grants and things like that.
We're talking about the April 2nd election with WPR State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagendonk and the two constitutional amendments you'll find on the ballot. If you have a position on either of these ballots, feel strong, or either of these constitutional amendment questions and feel strongly either way, you are more than welcome to join us at any point. At 1-800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Anya, the other constitutional amendment question on ballots a week from tomorrow is about election workers. So what are supporters saying about this proposed amendment they'd like to see written into our Constitution?
Yeah, so this amendment says that only legally legally designated election officials can perform tasks in the conduct of elections. It's kind of a confusing question. It seems aimed at the practice of bringing in non-certified consultants, which was another practice in 2020 that some people objected to. According to Emily Lau, who we just heard from, it's unclear which tasks are being referred to in that question and also what constitutes an election official. Our elections depend on all kinds of civil servants who work in clerks' offices, sometimes IT specialists, volunteers sometimes take on, you know, outreach roles, voter education roles, things like that. So it's not entirely clear whether they would all be prohibited from doing what they do. And so Lau told me that if passed, this question is likely to actually involve a court's involvement to clarify some of those questions. But I think at its heart, what supporters are saying is that it's about not bringing in these consultants to kind of take precedent over, you know, the expertise of our clerks and our elections commission.
Yeah. What would constitute the conduct of elections as written in this proposed constitutional amendment, Anya? How far could conduct of elections extend in protecting against contractors or outside workers?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the open question, is it's not really entirely clear what tasks those are. There are so many little tasks that go into administering an election. So what would that, you know, would that preclude, for example, a volunteer who goes out and does voter outreach,
right,
you know, the knowledge and permission of a clerk's office, that kind of thing? It's sort of unclear. And so I think a court would need to get involved to clarify who and what is being described in this question.
But supporters are saying that this is intended to clarify who can work on elections, although this may end up in the courts to clarify who can work on elections.
Exactly. That's right.
All right. Last week, Governor Evers took action on a number of election-related bills. The governor signed a law about election worker protections. What does this law do, Anya?
Yeah. So again, you know, so much of what we're talking about is really left over from 2020. Since 2020, harassment and threats against election workers has just really increased dramatically. And many communities as a result have seen huge turnover among election workers. And so this was actually a bipartisan bill, came out of a significant amount of legislative study. And it's aimed at addressing that issue here in Wisconsin. So it would increase the penalties for attacking or harassing election workers. It makes them kind of a special protected class in the statutes in that way. And it would also protect more of their personal information. So it's harder to do what's called doxing, which is when you share someone's personal information online, usually with the intention of either intimidating them or opening them up to harassment or threats. And then it also includes whistleblower protections for clerks who report what they believe to be fraud or irregularities in elections.
Evers vetoed a bill that would propose giving observers more access to the election process. Anya, why did the governor reject this bill?
Yeah, another post-2020 bill. Election observers in Wisconsin are allowed to be at polling places and present during recounts. And in 2020, you know, there was so much scrutiny on the elections and especially on the recounts in Milwaukee and Dane counties. So many more people than is typical started getting involved as observers. And so this GOP bill would sort of build on that, and wanted to make it even easier for observers to do what they do. So it would have made them able to sit much closer to poll workers, election workers, and then also have access to more parts of the election counting process. Evers' argument in vetoing the bill is that, existing rules for observers already exist, provide transparency into our election process. But he argues that, election workers also need to feel safe and be able to do their jobs. And so there's a little bit of a balance between the observation aspect and then what, might constitute intimidation or just sort of generally gum up the wheels a bit.
Anya Van Wagendonk is WPR State Capitol reporter and our guest for our State Capitol Report this morning. We welcome you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're getting ready for Election Day, Tuesday, April 2nd in Wisconsin. We're also getting updates on recent actions by the state legislature and state Supreme Court and what they may mean for our next election days. Our guest, Anya Van Wagendonk, is WPR State Capitol Reporter, and you are welcome to join us with your questions, comments. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, it was what, 2022 when the state Supreme Court ruled unsupervised ballot drop boxes would be illegal in Wisconsin's elections. But earlier this month, the state's new majority agreed to take up a case revisiting this issue once again. What may be significant about the state Supreme Court's actions here, Anya?
Yeah, again, this is another kind of outcome of the 2020 election. So many more people voted absentee because of COVID than was typical. And so there were these kind of both conspiracy theories about mass ballot dumps taking place, and that, has been debunked, but then also just kind of these unanswered questions about how they're used in general that had just never really been raised because we'd never seen that volume of use before. And we'd also never seen a presidential election outcome challenged in that way. And so some of those questions were brought before the court, as you mentioned, that ruling in July of 2022 that ruled that drop boxes as they'd been used just wasn't allowed. And so that was under the old conservative majority on the court. We now, of course, have a liberal majority as of last year. And so a new lawsuit was filed about that. And the court recently said that they'll take a look at that. And so it's significant because, we're in this major election year. We're 7 months out from the general presidential election. And so we're having these kind of administrative details hammered out kind of in real time. So in theory, it's possible that the very way that we can cast ballots in this state will change not insignificantly in the next 7 months.
But is there a chance that drop boxes, is there any chance that a state Supreme Court decision could make drop boxes available before the spring elections a week from tomorrow?
No. Okay. Oral arguments in this case are scheduled for May. And so the April elections, next week's elections, will proceed much in the same way as the 2022 midterms did. So that means that voters who want to vote absentee, they can go, vote early absentee right now or obviously on election day. But there will not be drop boxes, on the sidewalk or outside of a library the way that, folks might remember in 2020.
There's another bill that would have allowed election clerks to process absentee ballots the day before Election Day, and that proposal died in the state Senate earlier this month. What does this bill failing to get a vote mean for election workers on Election Day, Anya?
Yeah, so this was another actually bipartisan proposal. It would have given clerks the ability to just start processing ballots, as you mentioned, a little bit earlier. And that's particularly important in a place like Milwaukee, where there's just such a larger population than in most of the rest of the state. And so their results often come out much later at night. And again, in 2020, that really kind of fueled some conspiracy theories of so-called ballot dumping, that something shady happened after hours in Milwaukee, when really what happened was the polls closed and then people had to count all night. I was present at Central Count as that was happening. And so, anyways, this was kind of given as an idea of increasing voter transparency and awareness and trust by having these things kind of again take place a little bit more quickly. So the bill not moving through means that nothing changes. It's possible we won't have, a 3 a.m. outcome from Milwaukee as we did during COVID, because it's not a COVID election in the same way, but we will probably still have a pretty late night out there.
Anya Van Wagenendonk is a WPR State Capitol reporter. You covered the elections in Wisconsin in 2020, and since we've been talking about constitutional amendments regarding the 2020 election and legislation that goes back to the 2020 election and state Supreme Court decisions that goes back to the 2020 election, Anya, you covered the election in Wisconsin. What was wrong with the 2020 election in Wisconsin?
Well, there were sort of two components to it. One was obviously that the spring primary took place as COVID was really ramping up and nobody really knew what was going on. And so there was a mass, closing of polling places, for example, in Milwaukee, that led to many, many hours long lines. So elected leaders there and activists there have been really focused on that and that sense of kind of disenfranchisement of city residents there. But then in the 2020 general election in November, obviously we saw a proportion of supporters of former President Donald Trump who really did not accept the outcome of the election. Obviously, he himself did not accept the outcome of the election, and there were these significant challenges. And so our election system underwent an enormous amount of scrutiny and audits and recounts and court challenges and things like this. And so I think that we are continuing to feel rather the echo of that, even as, many prominent supporters of Trump have affirmed that Joe Biden lawfully won the election. And many members, prominent members of the Republican Party here in Wisconsin have said, it's time to move on. Let's focus on 2024 and beyond. You still do feel these echoes and ramifications just in terms of all of those little questions that just had never really come to the surface before, all getting a lot of attention.
And so another big change for Wisconsin, more recent than not, would be new state legislative maps. WPR reports that for the first time in more than 50 years, Wisconsin's state legislature and governor reached a bipartisan agreement on new maps for legislative districts. And this agreement in February gained some national attention. How soon could these new maps be used in our elections, Anya?
Yeah, so next week's election, the April election, is the presidential primary. So your state Senate or assembly district is not involved. So the maps will not be used next week. The August legislative primaries and then the November legislative general election will use the new maps. The open question right now is whether special elections or recall elections before August will use the new maps. And the Wisconsin Elections Commission has actually recently asked for clarity, from the courts on that question.
Anya, how would you, is there, have you seen a change in the Capitol since these new maps have been agreed upon and you have this half a century bipartisan agreement on how our mapping should look for legislative districts in Wisconsin? Has it changed the scene in the Capitol at all to you?
Yeah, that bipartisan word is really the important, I think, factor there. And so you would think when there is a large bipartisan accord like that, that there might be some sort of sense of, victory or progress or something. But I think really what it does is it puts a number of people who are now in more competitive districts in a little bit of a scramble to figure out, their reelection campaigns. And then also you do sort of sense a palpable sense from the Democrats that the tides might be shifting for them a little bit. It's kind of been understood for quite a while that Republicans just have so much power at the Capitol that, you know, Democratic legislation, for example, doesn't really stand a chance when it's brought forward if it doesn't have support across the aisle. And so now we will get a sense of whether that starts to shift as people feel, you know, that there's a little bit more competition in these seats. What does that do for kind of the political wheeling and dealing that takes place in the Capitol?
And Anya, what are you looking for next on your beat? What's next in the Capitol and the elections for you?
Yeah, well, so in theory, the legislative business is kind of wrapped up for the year. They could come back, but they've sort of officially adjourned for the year. And so we will be really kind of shifting our attention away from that kind of legislative movement and towards the elections. There will be, you know, more than 100 legislative races here, obviously, U.S. Senate, U.S. Congress, and obviously the presidential. And of course, Wisconsin is so important to the presidential. And so we will be, I think, receiving a lot of visits from the campaigns. And so that'll really be, I think, the focus of the next several months of my life will just be on those election factors.
Looking forward to it. Anya, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anya Van Wagner-Donk, WPR State Capitol Reporter, and your State Capitol Report continues after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Listening to the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent this morning. And now that Wisconsin's 2023-2024 scheduled legislative floor voting period has come to an end, there are some Democrats saying there is more work to be done, work that they say could help families and improve the quality of life in Wisconsin. What do you say? Join our conversation this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Questions for our guest? 1-800-642-1234. Always email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Sheila Stubbs represents a Madison district in the Wisconsin Assembly. She serves on both the Committee on Corrections and Committee on Criminal Justice and Public Safety. Representative Stubbs, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
And let's start with this task force that you have been working on trying to create to address the inordinate number of Black women and girls who are murdered or go missing in Wisconsin. The proposal failed to advance in the Senate this session. What do you hope this task force would accomplish, Representative Stubbs?
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much for giving me this interview. I'm really, really appreciative. You're right. Absolutely. Assembly Bill 615, Senate Bill 568, unfortunately, and I want to underscore that, did not make it to the governor's desk for a signature this session. The momentum was broad and it was bipartisan support. And this legislation, this session, both made me proud of the efforts that I have from local to national media networks, organizations, victims, family members that come forward. And next time, I want you to know that I do plan on reintroducing this legislation, and I hope that it will be signed into law.
Representative Stubbs, when did you first introduce this legislation?
Yeah, so I've been working on this legislation almost 3 years. Mm-hmm. This session, I started with introducing the legislation on October 31st. And it was introduced for the first time to the committee in on the assembly side and criminal justice, public safety, and the bill was passed unanimously from the assembly committee on criminal justice and public safety, which I was so honored and so proud. We had a victim family member come forward. Her name was Georgia Hill. Her daughter name is Lashiki Hill. And Lashiki Hill became missing one day before her 46th birthday. And again, I gave you the wrong date, but it was January 17th of 2024 that the bill was introduced in criminal justice, public safety. And then on January 24th of 2024, the bill was exempt, which means that we voted on the bill, and that's where it was unanimous. And so that was great for me to see take forth and many of the organizations and victims' families. And then on February 22nd, which was my birthday, which I got the best gift, which were bills on the assembly floor. I had six bills on the floor, which is amazing. The bill was taken up, and we voted for the bill on the assembly floor, and it passed. It passed on a voice vote, which is absolutely amazing, which means one of the houses, we were finished.
Yeah.
Now we needed to start that same work again on the Senate side. And that's when I continue to follow the track of where is this bill? Where is the process? And on October 31st, that's when this bill was read first time and referred to the committee on the assembly organization. And so that's when I started watching what was happening. And then the assembly bill 568 was introduced in the Senate, read for the first time and referred to the Senate committee on government operations. And so I'll just put a pin there, because that's when I start questioning what is happening. Why is this bill referred to government operations? I'll be honest, I didn't know much about that committee, but I knew one thing. Why was this bill sent to this one committee when all the other bills for the assembly committee on the task force bills, which assembly bill 615 was a standalone with a package of bills, which was from the speaker's task force on human trafficking.
Yeah.
Why was this bill isolated and sent to this government operations committee? So I began
Representative Stubbs, where did the other bills from the human trafficking task force end up in the Senate? What committee did they go to?
Criminal justice.
And you would have liked to have seen your proposal for a task force go to the criminal justice committee in the Senate, but instead it went to, what is it, government administration?
Government operations.
Government operations. And what happened in that committee to your proposal for a task force on missing and murdered African-American women?
I'm so glad you asked me, because first I needed to find out who the senator was that was the chair. I learned it was Senator Dewey Strobel. So I had my office schedule a meeting. I met with him. I asked him about the committee. And then I asked, why was this bill sent to your committee when all the other bills were sent to the Criminal Justice Committee in the Senate? And he said, well, I don't get a chance to choose where the bill is sent. It was sent to my committee from my leadership. And I said, okay, well, when is the bill going to have a hearing? And he said to me, I'm not going to give this bill a hearing.
Oh.
And I said, what? He said, I'm not going to give it a hearing. And I said, why? He said, well, two things. First of all, if we give this bill a hearing and we do a task force for the African-American community, we need to do it for everybody else. And I said, okay, I'm fine with that. That's not a problem for me. I mean, if we need to do it for the Latino community and the Asian community, in the Latino community, I'm okay with that, because guess what? We're already doing it for the Indigenous Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm okay with that. And he said, well, you know, I'm not okay with that. And then he alluded that that side of the House, meaning the Senate, we kill 300 bills a session. And I said, and you're proud of that? That's not a moment to be proud of. We work really hard. People, you know, my colleagues work really hard in the assembly to get bills heard. You work with families, you work with communities, you get bill ideas. And that became a problem for me. And he said he wasn't going to give the bill a hearing. So I reached out to my supporters, both nationally and locally. And I asked people to start calling his office and to start emailing him. And that's what started happening. And media started asking questions. And there was a lot of advocacy that happened. Well, I went back on March 7th. That's when we noticed something happened. From October 23rd, he said no, meaning Senator Strobel. I had another meeting with him, I want to say in February-ish. And I asked if he would reconsider. It was after February 22nd, because it had passed the assembly side. So I wanted to give him an update and say, hey, the bill's moving. Here's what's happening. And he said, well, I've been doing some research and I see that there's high numbers of missing and murdered African-American boys and men. Would you be willing to amend the bill? And I said, absolutely. Okay. If that's what it takes to get the bill heard in your committee, absolutely. So he gave me a 15-minute slot and he said, well, he started talking about some correctional issues and criminal justice issues around the state of Wisconsin. And then he said, well, I'm not convinced. And my mind had to change. And I walked out of his space, out of his office. I said, are you kidding me? And so I then reached back out to groups and organizations and asked them to reach back out to his office. Hmm. And media was helpful. And on March the 5th, it was a couple of days before, I want to say the first Tuesday in March, we got a phone call and an email from Senator Jesse James' office, who is the lead senator on this bill. And his office called to say that the bill had been removed from Senator Strobel's committee, which was the committee, Senate Committee on Government Operations.
Representative Stubbs.
Like, hallelujah.
Yeah. So where is it now? Where does this proposal for a task force on missing and murdered African-American women stand?
Yes. So the committee, Government Operations, referred it to the Senate Committee on Mental Health, Substance Abuse Prevention, Children and Families. So once it got referred on March the 7th, we received a second hearing on the bill. And then the bill was given an executive action took place and it passed unanimously, right? So I'm excited. Yes, the bill's going to make it to the Senate floor. That's when things changed. The bill never made it to Senate floor. So I am still questioning why.
And you don't have an answer for that yet.
No.
Representative Sheila Stubbs, a Democrat who represents Madison in the State Assembly, our guest for your State Capitol Report, taking a look at her proposal, years in the making, for a task force on missing and murdered African-American women. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And just in the last couple of weeks, Representative Stubbs, you introduced a bill that would allow municipal governments to enact some stricter gun control laws, stricter than the state has in place. A measure would eliminate a state preemption enacted back in 95. I'm wondering, what laws do you envision local governments could adopt here if your legislation passed?
Well, I'm glad that you asked. I think the timing is right for this particular legislation. I've had this legislation introduced before. We're hoping that each of the municipalities, our law enforcement, would agree that this legislation is critical and helping within our communities. We all know that there has been a rise in gun violence, especially in Madison, from our parks to our community centers to our communities. And I can just say that I know firsthand that we need to do something. We have to continue to try to be creative to reduce what's happening harmfully in our community. So this bill, let me be clear, we introduced it. I introduced it last week. Session is over. I would need to reintroduce the bill next session. But I think it was important for everyone to know what I was thinking and how I was thinking that this bill could be beneficial throughout our community.
Representative Sheila Stubbs, our guest, and we invite you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. It's your State Capitol Report on the morning show. And when we continue, we'll take a look at the state of our Wisconsin Department of Corrections, what's going on inside, and how outside the walls of our prisons we may be making decisions that'll impact the inmates within and those that work there as well. We'll ask our guest, Representative Stubbs, about that and her role on the Committee on Corrections and Committee on Criminal Justice and Public Safety when we continue here on the morning show. This is your State Capitol Report on the Morning Show, and I'm Lee Rayburn. We're talking about public safety, criminal justice, and Wisconsin's prisons with our guest, State Representative Sheila Stubbs from Madison. We welcome you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Before we get to our prisons, we've got a couple of questions here about the proposal we talked about from Representative Stubbs that would allow local governments to enact stricter gun control laws than the state has in place. And we'll start with Mark in New Berlin. Mark, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Say, I'm sorry, I just tuned in a few minutes ago and caught the end of your guest's comments, but she never answered the question, what would her law allow? And I'm wondering, would this mean that we've got this maze of areas in the state that it's legal to have a gun, it's not legal to have a gun? If I'm driving through Wisconsin on my way to go up hunting up north, as we say down here, down south in New Berlin, what do I have to do? I mean,
yeah.
if I've got a firearm, I've got a license to carry, a license to conceal carry.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. Let's get clarity about Representative Stubbs' proposal. Now, this bill would allow municipal governments to enact stricter gun control laws than the state has in place. But what would this mean for gun owners and hunters who are traversing the state of Wisconsin, Representative Stubbs?
Yeah, let me be clear. I am not trying to restrict those that have the authority to carry a gun. That's not my intent. But I think it's very clear that there are so many guns on the street for those who should not have the possession of a gun. But I think that it is clear to say that in order to stop so many of the tragedies and prevent so many of the deaths, we need to return the ability to enact stronger local gun policy to municipalities. I think every local government deserves the ability to enact common sense legislation. And for me, I mean background checks. I mean ERPO for those that there's domestic violence or mental illness that we know that people should not have the possession of a firearm, those that are felons. I think that is very clear what the intent of this to do, but we need to make sure that it fits those constituents. And so what works for small municipalities may not be the best policy for larger municipalities and metropolitan areas such as Madison and Milwaukee. And I think that it's very clear that what I am doing is I'm allowing local government, this bill is allowing local government to decide what's best for them. As I travel across the state and as I represent many voices across the state, local control really are, you know, many of the answers to the situations. I'm a former county board supervisor of 16 years. I know the importance of local residents and constituents having a say, that maybe the state of Wisconsin may say something, but local government needs to also be able to have their voice heard. I want to be clear to the caller. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. But this bill, because session is over, it's not going anywhere. It was introduced. So I would need to reintroduce the bill next session. Before we would even consider committees and things like that.
Let's go to Heidi next. Heidi is in Madison. And Heidi, you're on the air with State Representative Sheila Stubbs.
Hi. I appreciate the time to ask this question. So a few things you said sort of have made my point that there's too many guns already on the streets, and most of them are not there legally. So those people already are not following the laws. And we have so many gun laws, the background checks, all of those, which, you know, I'm a gun owner. I have concealed carry. I went through all of that to be able to get my gun. And I'm wondering what another piece of legislation is going to do when we don't follow the legislation we already have.
Thank you, Heidi. Representative Stubbs, are we enforcing the laws on the books already, and would more laws be more problems, or are we not enforcing these laws, and maybe enforcement would be the best first steps?
Yeah, I think that the answer to your question, Heidi, is, yeah, I think that there are already existing laws. You and I are very clear, and people are breaking the law, but I think whatever law we can put in effect that gives more localized control over legislation to keep our communities safe, to that each town and each city and each village in our state will be empowered to create really good gun safety policy that reflects the needs and values of those residents. And so one more piece of legislation certainly could reach that person that's not compliant already with existing legislation. I think it's just one more tool in the toolbox that could be used.
Representative Stubbs, you sit on the Assembly Committee on Corrections, and we recently had the retirement of Department of Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr. We have the Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice, investigate the smuggling of contraband in the Waupun Correctional Institution. We've had four deaths since last June at the Waupun Correctional Institution, including one from fentanyl and one by suicide. What's happening to our correction system in the state of Wisconsin from your perspective?
Yes, thank you for asking that particular complex but reality question. Let me first say that I extend my condolences to the families of persons in our custody that have passed. I am a former probation parole agent myself of 8 years, so I certainly have visited many of our institutions around the state of Wisconsin. I'm also the ranking member on the Assembly Committee on Corrections. So I've had an opportunity to have a little bit more robust conversations. The reality is we have problems, right? Anytime that you're doing oversight for individuals, especially from an incarceration perspective, you can put as many laws in place, but you will have some issues. I want to thank Secretary Carr for his years of service in the correctional perspective, but also for his years of service for the state of Wisconsin. I've had a chance to talk with Secretary Carr. My office get numerous emails and family members calling to advocate for their loved ones. We take every concern, complaint, email seriously. We reach out to Anna, who is the liaison for the Department of Corrections. Many times we can't get information because it's confidential. So family members would write us, we could ask the questions, but because of confidentiality restrictions, there's only so much that my office can do. But you best believe that we do all the advocacy that we can for families, for persons in our custody. I have visited Waupun myself this summer, last summer in 2023. And I also visited Fox Lake to specifically talk with persons in our custody, ask questions, see the conditions of their living. We were able to go into some of the pods and look at the food they're eating, even being offered a plate. I had some concerns with Waupun. It was so hot. And because of the limitations of correctional officers, there was restrictions for showering. There was, you know, it was massively hot. It was a hot day and it was extremely hot. So one of the things that I did is came back, met with some of my colleagues and on the Democratic side, and we introduced some bills, confinement bills. And one of mine was on hygiene. One of mine was on cultural competency. It was a lot of areas. So,
Representative Stubbs, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. And for that, I do apologize. Representative Sheila Stubbs represents a Madison district in Wisconsin Assembly. And sorry for cutting you off there. This is a State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And with spring officially here and warmer temperatures around the corner, right around the corner, we're revisiting a program from our archives about organizing and decluttering our spaces. What do you say? Experts say the best way to downsize and simplify is in stages. Bit by bit, room by room, drawer by drawer, closet by... You got the point. I like the fact that this job doesn't require any fancy tools. Friends and relatives can easily pitch in. So what is your strategy for spring cleaning? Share your tips by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us ideas at WPR.org. As we listen back to Kate Archer Kent's conversation with Britt Blackwelder, a professional organizer in Milwaukee and owner of the British Way. Their conversation starts with Britt sharing her experiences cleaning and organizing in the spring. And then Kate and Britt move on to advice for helping in garages.
Oh, gosh. So just being an organizer, I find I'm constantly organizing things around my home. But especially right now, you know, during spring, top of mind things are the linen closet. So switching over duvets and washing, you know, pillow covers and your bed linens. Also, you know, thinking about things like your garage and now that the weather's getting a little bit nicer, I think, here in Milwaukee, pulling everything out of the garage and, you know, getting all the leaves out and really just giving it a fresh look and feeling great about your garage. So those are just a couple of things.
Okay, so we're going to tackle the garage head on here. What approach do you take to, like, keeping and tossing things in your garage? How should we go about this?
So it's really great if you can have designated spaces. So, you know, first and foremost, I will say, as much as people don't want to hear this, to be able to devote, you know, to try to devote a day to really giving your garage the attention it needs. So by that, I mean pulling everything out, every last thing, if you can, again, cleaning it out, figuring out what do you have in there? What do you want to keep? What can you donate? What can you recycle? And then setting your garage back up in stations. So you may have stations for, you know, your recycling station, put it close to your door so that as soon as you walk out into your garage, it's right there and you're less likely to throw boxes out and just throw things into your garage. Instead, it's got a home. You want to have spots for, you know, kids' toys if those are things that you have. Where do your bikes live so that they don't just clutter up space and get in the way every time you're trying to get to your car or to your tools? Having a space for your tools, having a space for any household items that you might have. So really designating zones so that things don't get out of control quickly.
Yeah, the bikes, watch your head if you have them hanging from the ceiling like we do. But, you know, when you look at all these shelving system options that are out there for organization and especially garage organizations and shelving and these wall solutions, what guidance can you give us there?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can really go as simple or as all in as your budget can afford or as you're looking for. So this is certainly not an ad for any companies, but, you know, I do often recommend the Container Store. I know that Chicago Closets and Cabinetry also has some great options, and that's really going to run the gamut of prices and of solutions. You can have something that looks like you've walked into a showroom. You can have something that's simply just, you know, track system so that you can properly place your tools and have some drawers and some pegboards for gardening type supplies. So it really depends on budget. And you don't even really need to spend very much money to have an organized garage, to be honest. There are some very inexpensive systems, and not even systems, but just accessories that you can purchase and put up in your garage so that, again, everything has a home and you don't feel like you're walking into a zoo every time you walk into your garage.
We're talking with Britt Blackwelder, who's a professional organizer. We're learning how to reorganize our homes. You know, Britt, in the garage, the floor of the garage can get so nasty. Is there any cleaner that you would recommend using, or how should we get our garage floors clean?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I wouldn't say I've encountered that a lot. I will say that, you know, I know that obviously, you know, keeping your garage door open and leaves blowing in and dirt getting in there and that kind of thing. I mean, if you can make it even a seasonal project to at least pull things out and clean it out on a quarterly basis or maybe every 6 months, that's going to be one of the best ways to keep it clean. You're going to, you know, not run into things really building up on the floor if you've potentially got a little oil spill or an oil leak or things from other tools, electronic tools that you may have in your garage. So being able to do it routinely, again, I know that's not always what people want to hear because, you know, they want it done. It's a bigger project, but that can be a great way to not have those things build up and then it's impossible to remove them.
So looking more broadly here at the whole efforts to go toward minimalism and that whole trend, what do you make of that as people look to declutter and, you know, lead more simplistic lives?
Yeah, I think that there are extremes, right? And so I myself do not, you know, prescribe to the method of having, you know, four things in your living room. Sometimes that's just not realistic, especially if you have kids or you're into a lot of different activities. So for me, more so, it's hanging on to the things that, and to, I guess, kind of, you know, quote Marie Kondo, but really the things that bring you joy, the things that you use, the things that are functional for you and your family. So not worrying so much about like, oh, you know, would a minimalist judge me if they walked into my house? But do items have a home? If they don't, maybe that's a good sign that, okay, maybe you need to find them a home, but also that maybe those aren't items that are serving you anymore and you can pass them along to someone that could use them.
How do you decide, though, which things to keep, which things to either throw away or give away? How do you make those distinctions?
Yeah, so it can be tough. You know, I've got a couple of thoughts there. So I would say that one is, it depends on the room, first of all. So, you know, if you're going if you've got a library at your house and books are your passion, I'm certainly not going to come into your home and say, well, let's really narrow these down. I know you love all of these, but it depends on what somebody's goals are. So if you're going through your clothes, for example, try them on. How do they make you feel? When was the last time that you wore them? Do you really love this item, or are you just keeping it to make your closet look more full and, you know, make yourself feel like you have more options? And really a more narrowed down closet will make you feel less stressed because, you know, you can go right into your closet and grab something that you know you love. Same thing in your garage. When was the last time you used your fifth rake? You know, when was the last time you used, you know, whatever it might be. So going into your linen closet, sure, you loved this pattern 5 years ago, but is it really something that you're going to put back on your bed, or could you pass it along? Could you donate it to an organization? So just things like that. It does really depend on the room. And then also, I know this will seem like an obvious answer coming from a professional organizer, but having somebody there with you that is an unbiased third party to kind of ask you those questions. Do you use this item? Do you love this item? And then kind of give you permission to let go of it. Some people need to just tell that story one last time. Some people like to let somebody else hear it. Some people need someone to tell them it's okay that you don't want to keep this gift that your mother-in-law gave you 10 years ago that you don't really love and you never use. It's not your responsibility to hang on to gifts that people have given you. So I think those are just some things to kind of help hopefully give people a little bit of, you know, motivation or encouragement to part with some of those things that they've been struggling with.
That is Britt Blackwelder, a professional organizer based in Milwaukee. With spring cleaning season underway, we're re-listening to a conversation about decluttering and simplifying our spaces. You can join in by sharing your advice at any time, and we'll try to pass it along during our show at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back with more advice on springtime organizing. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and signs of spring are popping up across Wisconsin. Flowers in bloom, some buds falling over the weekend to the ground, migrating birds. Good morning, Robin, and temperatures on the rise after a milder winter, putting it mildly. This year, the spring equinox landed on March 19th, launching the unofficial start of spring cleaning season. Today, we're revisiting a wide-ranging program on decluttering, where Kate Archer-Kent spoke with Britt Blackwelder, a professional organizer based in Milwaukee. And we want to welcome your spring cleaning advice along the way as well by calling us 1-800-642-1234 or emailing us ideas@WPR.org. So let's pick up the conversation where Kathleen in Wauwatosa called in to ask about managing inherited possessions.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. While things like clothing and so forth are easy to get rid of, what do you do with things that you may have inherited that have some monetary value? How do you find places to get rid of those, like sets of sterling silver, for example, that may have been inherited, and that sort of thing?
Ah, sterling silver, fine china. Britt, what would you suggest?
Yeah, so thanks for calling in, Kathleen. So that is a tough area right now. I know that a lot of my clients, especially clients that are a little bit older, that have kids that have maybe said, I'm not interested in taking on your fine china. I'm not interested on taking some of those items that are getting passed down. Those are tough, I will say. I have seen some very creative solutions for things like that, but it's it does kind of mean parting with some of them. So something I do tell clients that have maybe a set of china, a set of, you know, teacups or something that's very special to them, is to hang on to one of those items as sort of a symbol of a collection. I know that other clients of mine have found success in use, and this may make you cringe a little bit, but if kind of letting this sink in, it maybe could help. Even gifting, whether it's you make cookies or you make bread, you make something for a friend or a family member, instead of giving it to them on a plastic plate or a styrofoam plate, gifting it on a beautiful china plate that continues to be regifted and regifted. Something like that can be a great option. And unfortunately, a lot of stores that I have spoken with are not taking a lot of those items right now, just because they are inundated with those types of things and they just don't sell very well. So I hate to give you that answer, but that can be one creative solution to pass it on and to give it as a gift.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Nicole is joining us from Madison. Hi, Nicole. What would you like to share? What's your situation?
So I'm moving in with my fiance here within the next month, and we've been working together to kind of reorganize his home and try to figure out things that we can part with. My biggest issue is that when we clean up small spaces, like the living room where things have a tendency to collect, like game controllers and things like that. I find myself like organizing that space and then everything kind of just winds up everywhere again. I use a lot of those little boxes you find at like home goods stores. So for example, you can pile a bunch of stuff up in a little box and have it set next to the ottoman or the couch for things you use all the time. But yeah, it just kind of winds up everywhere again, and I kind of am struggling, and I don't want to cause a rift or anything.
Oh, Nicole, thank you. Britt.
Yeah, that is that's a great question. I know those things, you know, combining homes or maybe different, you know, habits colliding and maybe not being 100% the same there can definitely be tricky. If my husband is listening, I would say he and I kind of ran into that a little bit. He's not a super unorganized person, but I'm a very organized person. And so really, as much as you can talk about it, kind of talk through how it makes you feel and get his perspective on how he sees maybe how he sees that space, how that space makes him feel, the organizing solutions that you've put in place, can you guys kind of make a, because it is, if you say it's a smaller space, can you guys kind of make a commitment to one another to respect how the other one feels about that space? So if he's not as, I don't want to say OCD, but if he's not as concerned about how tidy it is, can you maybe, you know, can you give a little, can he give a little, to the point where he's doing a little bit more to put things back. And if something isn't always in its right spot, you can, you know, kind of be understand that a little bit. But if you guys can communicate about that and share how you're feeling, it may help you guys both get to that point.
Yeah, because it requires some discipline to keep up the places that have already been organized. You've put in that time, you've put in that effort, but keeping it up, that to me is the tricky part.
Absolutely. Yeah, not easy. But the worst thing too is having this beautifully organized space, and then, you know, you turn around a couple days later and you sort of feel like all your hard work was for nothing. So getting it to that point and then being able to do those little things to just put items back into their homes. And I know sometimes that can be easier said than done, but even if you do every couple of days, you sort of do a general sweep of areas so that you don't feel this burden daily of having to pick up and, oh, this isn't organized again, this is messy again. If you can just say, you know what, I'll give it a couple days. In 2 days, I'll do a general sweep of the house, put things back where they go. And that may make you feel a little bit better and a little less overwhelmed.
We're talking about spring cleaning, decluttering, and Britt Blackwelder is our guide this hour to cleaning and decluttering our homes. She's a Wisconsin-based professional organizer. So, Britt, let's move on to kids, because, you know, we talk here about not being able to maintain the spaces that we've already decluttered. You know, how do we get kids involved in the process? Do you have any ideas on how to keep up their rooms? For goodness sake.
Kids. Yeah, definitely. So I know many of my clients have said they want to get to a place where things are organized, so then they feel like they can teach their kids how to keep up with it, how to put things back. So I can understand, you know, if people are saying, you know, I don't feel like I have those tools to teach them to organize, because I don't feel organized myself. So I definitely understand that. I really enjoy helping out in those situations, helping moms, helping dads, families feel like they can get to that point, that fresh reset. And then there are a lot of great products out there. What I will say, something that's really helpful for kids that maybe aren't reading yet, is using symbols on bins. So if it's where the dinosaurs go, they don't know the word dinosaur, putting a dinosaur symbol on it. So they see the dinosaur, they see where the dinosaurs go. Same thing with cars and trucks, or with, you know, with dolls, those kinds of things. So again, the biggest thing is having a home for items, separating them out, making sure that they're at the kids, you know, level, so that they can actually put them away. If they're high up on shelves, that's not going to do you any good, because you're going to feel like you have to do it every mm-hmm. time the room needs to get organized again. And then, you know, for kids' rooms, I always go back to, you know, clothing and making sure that the closet isn't maybe overflowing or stuffed with clothes, and maybe having a few toys or books in their room. But if you can have a different location where you have a majority of the toys or the books, and that's a space that can keep organized so that there isn't a lot of crossover from playroom to kids' room. And there's kind of that separation if you have the space to do that. And I realize not everybody does, but that can be a great way to keep the kids' room, you know, clean, but then also have kind of a play area that gets picked up. And one of the, you know, chores or daily activities or weekly activities is to pick up and put things where they go. Again, sometimes using those symbols if they're not at a reading age.
But those Legos, they migrate everywhere. You find them, oh my goodness, they're just everywhere.
Yeah. So, and Legos, I've seen different things about, you know, color coding your Legos. And while in theory, that is just so pretty to look at, I mean, it's beautiful, but it's also not completely realistic.
Oh, Legos. That's Britt Blackwelder, owner of The British Way, based in Milwaukee. And thanks again to Kathleen in Wauwatosa and Nicole in Madison for calling in when this program originally aired about organizing and decluttering, from garages to combining possessions to involving kids. We're revisiting a range of advice on spring cleaning this morning, so stay with us as the conversation continues ahead and we hear from more of you. You can call, also join in by sharing your advice. We'll try to pass it along during the show this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you declutter? Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and thanks for joining us this morning as we revisit a springtime program packed with advice for organizing your home. We're also inviting you to be a part of the conversation by sharing your spring cleaning tips. So how do you reduce clutter in garages, kitchens, and living rooms? How do you decide which things to keep and what to just let go? Call or email us your best insights, and we'll try to mention it during the program this morning. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Now let's return to Kate's conversation with Britt Blackwelder, a professional organizer in Milwaukee and the owner of The British Way. Tracy in Milwaukee will start us off here with a question about moving from a larger home, downsizing into a smaller one. Then we'll get advice on addressing home office spaces, collections of old photos, and closets.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I am about to move this summer from a four-bedroom house into a one-bedroom apartment, and I'm feeling overwhelmed, and I don't know where to start, and I don't know, like, what to take with me, and, you know, like, it all just seems,
Major downsizing. Yeah, Tracy, thank you. Britt, where does Tracy start?
Yeah, so Tracy, completely understand. I understand that that can be a very overwhelming experience. The best thing I can say, first of all, is to, you know, take a deep breath. Like, it's going to be, you're going to do this. It's going to be great. So if you can visualize your new space, be in your new space, think about how you envision that space. So what do you envision having in there? What do you envision needing? What do you envision that space looking like, that's going to make you happy, that's going to be functional? So if you can do that and then pick out the items in your current four-bedroom home that match that vision. So what from your current home can you take and put in your new space? And also, if you can start kind of thinking about it sort of a little bit room by room, the first thing you want to do is to try to take a bit of a smaller project on, so that you can get a little win under your belt, which will give you some momentum to take on the next project and to take on the next project. So if you can start with a project that something you don't feel a huge sentimental attachment to. So maybe it's your glassware, which may be a bad example, but if you can start with something like glassware that you may not have a huge sentimental attachment to, and start to narrow that down and say, okay, I really only have room for 10 glasses, but I have 30 of them right now. If you can do that, hopefully that will give you some good momentum to then take on that next little project. I would bet that as you continue to do those little projects, it's going to become easier and easier. You're going to tool yourself up with some of those just feelings of encouragement, and you're going to feel a bit more motivated to take on that next bigger project. And by the time you get to the big project, which may be your clothing, it may be things that you had in your garage, you're going to feel like, okay, I know how good it feels to get rid of those things that are not going to serve me in my new home. And I think you'll be surprised at what you'll be able to accomplish by the end of like building up that resilience and taking on the next bigger project.
Tracy, have you done that visioning exercise for your new apartment?
So I just was looking at like a sideboard table that I have, and just this morning, and was thinking,
where I really like that table. Where am I going to put it in the new space? So what you're saying makes a ton of sense for me, and it is very helpful.
Good. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I wish you the best of luck in your move.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks, Tracy. Let's look at the home office, since so many people have been working from home. Britt, how do you go about, you know, making this space productive and finding a place where you can really work from home?
Yeah. So, yeah, to your point, that has been a big area of focus for a lot of clients that I've worked with. So if there is a way that you can make your home office a designated space, obviously that is going to be the biggest, most obvious tip. If you can't, and if you kind of have to multi-purpose a room, really look at that room, look at what you've got in there, try to figure out what can you pull out of that room that you're definitely not using that's cluttering up that space. A lot of times I tell my clients that physical clutter can become mental clutter. So if in that room where you have your designated home office, you have a massive pile of photographs that you have had sitting there for years that you keep meaning to get to that you're just not getting to, take that picture project and move it out of that room. The last thing you want to do is every time you sit down at your desk, be bogged down by the reminders of what you haven't gotten done yet. So if you can do something like that, if there are other things in the room that are distractions or they're noisy or any of those things, if you can repurpose those, if you can put them in a different room, if you can donate them, if you're not using them, or just get rid of them, really just having that space be only work-related things as much as you possibly can. And then to really keep your desk, I know some people do prefer to work, I know some people do prefer to work with more items on their desk than fewer items on their desk. So I'm a person that I function best when my space is completely clear, but that's certainly not everybody. But if you can make a point towards the end of the day to clear off your desk, put things where they go, it's also going to help you walk into your quote unquote office the next day and get started instead of having to now clear off your desk. You've already done that. You're ready to hopefully start a very productive day.
Along those lines of pictures that you just mentioned, Diane and Madison called, and Diane's 74, going through photos, photo frames, trying to make decisions about what to do with old photos, and even photos, Diane says, of grandchildren that are now outdated. Diane asked, do you give them back? Do you save them, put them in a book? What do you do with all the photos?
Yeah, I mean, it's... It really depends on if she's trying to downsize, if she's trying to move and get rid of things. It also depends on if her family members want those items. So if she asks, do you want this picture of yourself, and they don't even want the picture, do you have other pictures of that person around that age? And so I know it sounds hard and it almost sounds evil, but starting to get rid of some of those pictures, keep the ones that are truly some wonderful memories. And I guess people could argue they're all good memories. And I do understand that, but if you can sort of go through those and don't keep ones that are, maybe it's multiple versions of the same picture, but just different angles, hang on to one of those. If it's not even a great memory, or if it doesn't really bring you that much joy, don't hang on to those. You can certainly store them in, there are some great photo organizers, little boxes within a big box that you can kind of categorize by year. You could categorize by person. You can certainly do photo books. If that would make you happier, There are also companies out there that scan pictures in and then can give them back to you digitally. So that's something that you could look at in your area to see if that's an option. That way you don't have the physical clutter, but you've got it. You've got the items on a DVD or on a disc. And I know that many people that are older than me are very tech savvy. And so that is a great option as well to give yourself a little bit more space.
We're talking about decluttering, spring cleaning with Britt Blackwelder, our guide this hour. And she is a professional organizer based in Wisconsin. Britt, the closets are overflowing. That can be a huge issue. And what would you suggest first with closed closets and keeping them orderly?
Yeah. So for closed closets, I mean, I myself have a pretty small closet. I basically have a rod that goes around. I have a shelf on top of that. And then I've actually done some baskets on the top of the shelf. Those all have labels. So they're either for t-shirts, they're for long sleeve shirts, they're for shorts, they're for workout gear, they're for lounging gear. For me, that is the best way to know exactly where to go for what I'm looking for. I also put my clothes sort of in order by, you know, I put dresses together, I put blouses together, short sleeve shirts, long sleeve shirts, just so I can, again, quickly grab something and I'm not rifling through trying to find what I'm looking for. I do switch out my wardrobe seasonally. There have been a few days that have been tempting to switch it over to summer, but I haven't officially done that yet. And so keeping things kind of separated from that perspective too can be really helpful. And there's one great trick that I love about closet organization and only keeping things that you wear. So if you put your clothes on the hanger and you turn it around, so you hang it the opposite way, when you have worn it and you put it back on the hanger, turn it back around.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll be able to see after, if you want to give yourself 6 months, a year, maybe because of the pandemic, a little bit longer. But you can then see what items you haven't touched in that amount of time. And it's just a really easy visually, you know, great way to figure out what you can give away and not feel guilty about because you haven't worn it and somebody else might.
Do you have any insights on what clothes should be folded and put into drawers versus being hung up in the closet?
So I have kind of a nice product. It's almost like stacking bins. It's like a canvas, almost like, I guess, a hanging shelf, really. And so I fold up my sweatshirts, hoodies, those kinds of things, some athletic tops, you know, zip up hoodies, those kinds of things. I do hang my my sweaters. I hang dresses. So it also depends, too, on what you have space for. Again, my t-shirts and long sleeve shirts get file folded and those go up in bins on the top of my closet. So if you can take a look at what you've got and then figure out how much space you have and figure out, okay, these categories, it would make sense to hang. I've got enough room for that. These, I'm okay if these are folded. These are hoodies. These are things that, that may not need to be hung. And then these are things that could potentially go into bins and be able to space it out like that. So that, again, you don't have everything hanging up where you're trying to rifle through and find things.
That is Milwaukee-based organizer Britt Blackwelder, who helps clean and declutter spaces for clients. And we're listening back to her conversation with Kate Archer Kent amid the spring cleaning season. It is upon us. There's still more advice ahead, and we welcome you to join in by sharing your organizing tips at any time. We'll weave them into the program before we're done. Call us 800-642-1234. Email us ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
WPR is proud to bring you the latest news and information about the spring general elections scheduled for Tuesday, April 2nd. To find out how to register, where to vote, how to vote absentee, and more, go to myvote.wi.gov. Myvote.wi.gov is maintained by the State of Wisconsin Elections Commission.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and let's get right back to Kate Archer Kent's conversation with professional organizer Britt Blackwelder. We're getting tips, tricks, strategies for keeping a clutter-free home. And your spring cleaning advice is also welcome as we listen back. 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And we'll try to pass along your advice before the end of the show this hour. And we're going to hear from Marcus next in Milwaukee. And then a couple more callers about letting go of possessions. Then Kate and Britt talk about organizing kitchens.
So I work for a number of landlords in the city of Milwaukee. I do remodeling and construction. And I end up, when I do cleanouts after people have moved out, there's a lot of stuff that's left behind. Now, this doesn't necessarily help cleaning out my own house, which is a mess of its own. I have kids. So, but like with the, you know, with the stuff that's left behind, I try to find places to like donate it. Like, obviously there's like Goodwill, St. Vincent de Paul, Purple Heart, those type of things. But I also try to look for like younger couples or families in need that are like moving into some of the units or whatever else. And there's plenty of homeless people out here. So, you know, there's lots of places to donate clothes and other things and help people get established and get on their feet again.
Marcus, thank you for that. Britt, go ahead. There are places for these items that we don't want.
Yeah, that is, that's great of you to call in and talk about that. That is so true. And yeah, I would definitely recommend people do that. There are also, you know, also great social media tools, Facebook and Instagram, where people can, you know, put the message out there and say, hey, if anybody's looking. I know a lot of times in a lot of different Facebook groups I'm in, there will be, you know, unfortunately, sad stories of people who are in dire need of things like that. So being on the lookout for that as well, you know, listen out for people who need things. Also listen out for people who are giving things away. Great opportunities to not just, you know, dump it at the Goodwill, but to really find a great home for it. And it can make you feel a lot better too about getting rid of something that you've really loved and cherished yourself.
Marcus, thanks so much. Lori and Nina called in to say that they're currently moving and Lori has gone through their items before, giving a lot away, but later feels some regret about it. How can Lori rethink or reframe this process so they don't make the wrong choices?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, I think that can be a natural part of the process. I think that, you know, a lot of times people do hold on to things for a long time. And so they've really had a while to kind of wrestle with the idea. And it can take you a while to then say goodbye to something. Some of those, you know, feelings of regret, hopefully those fade a little bit with time. You know, I guess one thing I would say is, unless it's something like some kind of prized possession or something extremely sentimental, if you gave away something that maybe, you know, wasn't very expensive, just keep in mind that you can always usually find that item again if you do truly, truly need it. So try not to hang on to something for that 1% of the time that you think you may need that item again. Your house could be filled with items that you may need 1% of the time. And just keep in mind, again, that if you truly do need it, you can possibly buy it again. You can also probably rent it. So don't think that if you've given something away that you have to replace it by buying it. There are so many options out there of things that you can rent for the day or the week or the month to supplement what you've given away. So I do hope those feelings of regret subside. I know that that can be difficult, but that's why it's important to give yourself time to make sure it's something that you want to part with, because you don't want to regret giving something away. That is going to make it harder for you to continue on that purging and organizing, decluttering journey. And you want to keep up that momentum if you can. So really give it some good thought, put it to the side, give yourself 6 months, a year. That's totally fine. You don't want to regret doing that.
Lori, thanks. You know, you're talking about using something 1% of the time. I think we should enter the kitchen and the gadgets and and the spice cabinet as we talk about this 1%. You know, where do we tend to go wrong with keeping our kitchens organized?
I think part of it can be out of sight, out of mind. Mm. So if you can organize things in a way, I mean, you just mentioned spices, and that's a great example. I have recently just been loving the concept of a spice drawer versus a spice cabinet. Now, not everybody has space to do that, and I completely understand, but if you do have space or could possibly switch things around so that you can have a spice drawer, when you open it, you can see everything right in one, you know, and in one go, in one sitting. So you're maybe less likely to hang on to ones that you don't use as often. Or if you do keep ones you don't use as often, it's okay because you've got that designated space for them. Otherwise, if you do have them in a cabinet, getting something like a tiered spice rack so that you can actually see what you've got versus just burying items behind items behind items so that you can see what's in there, going through them. I don't have a hard and fast rule about, you know, spices expiring. I don't think that they go bad. I think they just are a little bit less potent. And so I don't think it's necessarily as much about that, but it's more about keeping the ones that maybe you never use. If it's a 1%, there's nothing more frustrating than getting to a recipe that you need a pinch of something and you just got rid of that. So if you've got the space, definitely okay to hang on to it. Just make sure it's visible so that you're only keeping the things that you want to keep.
Well, let's bring in Jan in Viroqua. Hi, Jan. Jan, are you there?
I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, I've always wanted to start what I would call a share barn. For those 1% items out of the garage and the back closet that so that my neighbors and friends could have common access to them. I would think of it as, you know, like a lending library thing where everybody put their 1% items in a well-organized large space.
I love that. Jan, thank you. You know, there is another idea, Britt, for to do, you know, with those items that we just don't use that often.
That just brought a huge smile to my face. I think that is an awesome idea. I love it. I think that people would love that. And gosh, what a neat concept. I think that, you know, folks would even come just to see what are those 1% items. What do I not have that I'm missing out on? So I think that's a really fun idea. And if you end up doing that, Jan, I'm going to come out to your share barn.
That is Britt Blackwelder, a professional organizer based in Milwaukee. Her business is called The British Way, and she spoke with Kate Archer Kent about decluttering homes during the spring cleaning season. And over the hour, we've heard from a few of you about your suggestions about how to keep things decluttered in your own home and life. Ben and Toma called. Ben wants to recommend the material of Joshua Becker from BecomingMinimalist.com. He's an author who writes about owning less, and Ben says the book's been incredibly helpful for their family with feeling happier and owning less things. Thanks, Ben, for chiming in. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.